Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Keen Bott, who is an activist and a writer and who has organized a major effort to move a major human rights organization, Human Rights Watch, toward independence from the U.S. government. Keen, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Delighted to be with you, David.
So what have you done, and what is it that you want to see changed at Human Rights Watch?
In May, I organized an open letter to Human Rights Watch and its executive director, Ken Ross. And I was able to obtain the signatures of over 100 academics, scholars, human rights activists, journalists, and two Nobel Peace Prize laureates, Adolfo Pérez Esquivel of Argentina and Mairead McGuire, Ireland. And I was also able to recruit two UN officials for the effort, one being Richard Falk, who was up until recently the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, and Hans von Spanik, a German diplomat who was at one point the UN Assistant Secretary General. And so all of us published a letter on alternate.org encouraging Ken Ross to end what we called a revolving door policy to the United States government, through which high-level foreign policy operatives within various arms of the U.S. government would exert their influence, passing from the U.S. government's foreign policy divisions into Human Rights Watch and influencing its priorities and advocacy, and then going on once again into the foreign policy divisions of the U.S. government. We argued that because the United States is such a routine violator of human rights, that this created an immediate conflict.
So did you begin this effort as sort of a technical, procedural matter of policy, or because you had noticed behavior and positions and actions taken by Human Rights Watch that suggested bias in favor of the U.S. government?
It's definitely the second of the two. For a number of years, many scholars, particularly those attuned to Latin American affairs, had raised the alarm of the Human Rights Watch behaving as an adjunct to the U.S. government's foreign policy objectives within the Western Hemisphere.
For example,
in Venezuela, José Miguel Vivanco, the director of the Americas Division, when they published a 2008 report condemning Venezuela, he actually made a public statement saying that the reason why we actually are publishing this report is to show to the world that Venezuela is not a model for anyone. And this goes far beyond the objectives and the kind of reach of a human rights organization, which is to catalog human rights abuses and to condemn them regardless of the country, but to make a sweeping comment condemning the political and societal components of Venezuela is beyond the pale and is simply unconscionable for a human rights organization. And so that combined with empirical falsehoods in its coverage of Venezuela, which is a country that has for the past 15 years been relentlessly demonized by the State Department and by the corporate media in the United States, really kind of conforms with a foreign policy objective of the United States government. And so in addition to the demonization of Venezuela, which Human Rights Watch very loyally carries out, it has been very muted in its criticisms of human rights abuses perpetrated by the United States government and its allies in the hemisphere. So in the case of Haiti in 2004, its democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was essentially kidnapped by the United States government and was shipped aboard a plane, destination unknown, in the middle of the night on February 29th, 2004. And he ended up in the Central African Republic. The ensuing regime, the coup regime, basically presided over thousands of murders in Port-au-Prince alone, contributing to the worst human rights crisis of the hemisphere at that time. Human Rights Watch never held a press conference, never published an op-ed condemning the coup or the post-coup atrocities in any major newspaper that I could ever find. Human Rights Watch basically did nothing. It barely lifted a finger in the wake of this catastrophe, this human rights catastrophe. And again, the elected government of Haiti was relentlessly vilified by the U.S. government and by the corporate media, and was deposed finally through this action by the U.S. government after U.S. support for a destabilization campaign, beginning with the cutoff of aid and then actually ramping up to supporting paramilitary goons that rampaged and terrorized the northern area of Haiti. So these two cases are indicative of a really serious problem, which is that Human Rights Watch basically falls in line with U.S. priorities. And this is simply unacceptable for an organization that calls itself independent. So what I'm doing is I'm taking the criticisms of these particular cases and I'm tying them to a structural reason, something in the constitution of Human Rights Watch and its personnel, which is that if it populates its board of directors with a person who is responsible for war crimes, in this case, Javier Solana, the former NATO Secretary General in 1999, who initiated a war in violation of the UN Charter, and who presided over war crimes like the use of cluster munitions and the deliberate bombing of a civilian target, a television station that killed 16 civilians. These are the kinds of people that will corrupt an independent organization and move its priorities towards ways that are more convenient for the United States and its North Atlantic allies, and are very much more critical than the facts allow in the case of Venezuela.
I imagine you have examples from the other hemisphere as well, hotspots around the world. I certainly recall a report on drone killing by Human Rights Watch that rather bizarrely concluded, in a very similar manner to one by Amnesty International, that they just couldn't tell if this particular drone murder was legal or not. They weren't sure whether the president was claiming it was part of a war or not. The president hadn't shown them his secret memos and thought processes and so forth, as if the person responsible for killing someone with a drone, with a missile from a drone, gets to decide whether it's legal or not. It struck me as bizarre.
Yeah, and actually your readers, your listeners should actually read your own articles on that, which clearly explain this. But I'd like your listeners to imagine for a moment that China or Russia were actually, sending out robotic planes around the planet, treating any military-aged male as a legitimate militant target, and would only exonerate them after they had killed them and found out later that they were not involved in any kind of imminent attack on them. This kind of a terror campaign in which entire communities are ravaged and are at any moment subject to, being vaporized by these robotic planes flying above. This kind of terrorizing of civilian populations throughout the entire planet, and the right that the United States confers onto itself to conduct these kinds of operations, if this were any other country you know, participating in such a campaign, it would immediately be denounced by human rights organizations. And the fact that Human Rights Watch's only criticism is one of a lack of transparency, as you said, being unable to access the kind of legal rationales and the mental, you know, justifications of its leaders is extremely bizarre. In the case of Cuba, Cuba has a much better case for conducting missile strikes on Miami, where there are self-admitted terrorists like Jose Posada Carriles, who live as free men in Miami and who have, you know, admitted to carrying out and being the masterminds to terrorist acts. In the case of the United States, it can't even muster that. For example, with Abdullah Rahman Al-Awlaki, a 16-year-old child that they drone assassinated and don't have any legal justifications for. So the fact that the United States government and its executive maintain an extrajudicial secret kill list that confers onto them the right to kill anyone, U.S. citizen or otherwise, anywhere on the planet, is an authoritarian policy that is literally inconceivable for any other country. And the fact that Venezuela is so the fact that Human Rights Watch is so quick to describe Venezuela as an authoritarian society and its executive as an authoritarian, and to never use that term for a president who has gone beyond any kind of conceivable limits on executive power, is really redolent of this problem that we have with Human Rights Watch allying itself closely with U.S. foreign policy.
We're speaking with Keen Bhatt. Keen, you have now debated Ken Roth of Human Rights Watch on the Democracy Now! Program.
Reed Brody, the spokesperson of Human Rights Watch.
Oh, I'm sorry, you mm-hmm. debated him. But you and your co-authors of this open letter have generated a response from Human Rights Watch and then a response of your own to theirs. What has this exchange consisted of? Has there been any sort of interest on the part of Human Rights Watch in what you're proposing?
Human Rights Watch has completely evaded the core request on our part, which is to implement either a ban or a cooling off period on anyone who has crafted or executed U.S. foreign policy because of the inherent element of human rights abuses consistent with the maintenance of a global military hegemon. And so Ken Roth signed a letter trying to evade and, in my opinion, lie about the cases that we brought up that suggested a conflict of interest between the personnel that it has retained and the kinds of objectives for independent, impartial human rights advocacy. So what we do in our response letter is tackle each one of the three cases which Human Rights Watch has insisted are being misinterpreted, and show that, in fact, in all three instances of Human Rights Watch advocacy, they are very clearly showing a behavior that is not consistent with independence or even, you know, basic principles of human rights and a respect for law. And we double down on our claims that there is, in fact, a revolving door, which Reed Brody on Democracy Now! Denied. And we show that in addition to people like Tom Malinowski, who once worked in the National Security Council as its senior director at the White House for Bill Clinton before moving on to becoming the chief lobbyist in Washington for Human Rights Watch, before again moving on to becoming the Assistant Secretary of State to President Obama. In addition to him, there are numerous other cases. So 1 week after we submitted our letter to Ken Roth, a senior researcher described his upcoming transition to the office of the UN ambassador from the United States Samantha Power. And we talked about how this raises very, very serious concerns, given that Samantha Power has unabashedly described the United States as the greatest country on earth and the leader in human rights and human dignity, and somebody who has stated that she will work tirelessly to defend Israel. And you know, says that the United States has nothing to apologize for. These are the kinds of statements that that are being made by the new boss to somebody who worked as a senior researcher. And when Human Rights Watch staff and advisory committee members and board of directors members and so on see that this is a condoned policy, whereby Human Rights Watch associates can move on and advance their careers within the State Department and work for people who should be criticized for their offenses and their crimes, this generates really perverse incentives and leads a lot of Human Rights Watch personnel to be less critical than they otherwise should be. So it's a very simple proposal. We double down on them. We reemphasize their importance. And we also include a new demand, which is to remove from Human Rights Watch's board of directors Javier Solana, the ex-NATO official. On the face of it, the leader of a military organization has no business whatsoever helping to guide and direct the operations and the vision of an independent human rights organization. And even less so when that person has initiated a war of aggression and has actually been criticized for, you know, leading an organization that's responsible for war crimes in Kosovo and Yugoslavia.
One would think that that was the case. On the other hand, it seems to me the position that Human Rights Watch takes and Amnesty International takes and possibly others is that there's nothing wrong with war. There's nothing wrong with militaries, that in fact the UN Charter and the Kellogg-Briand Pact are unworthy of recognition, that in fact it is their purview to look at particular atrocities within wars, but to accept that war exists, like the weather, as was the legal reality 100 years ago, but isn't any longer.
Yeah, this is insanity masquerading as realism and pragmatism. What they're saying is that the lone military superpower, which you know, has in it as its defense budget, you know, what the next 20 countries have combined as its military budget, that military superpower, which is not constrained by international law, which is not constrained by the United Nations, and has no check on it by any other kind of counter. Prevailing force can go and basically commit the supreme international crime under the Nuremberg Tribunal, which are wars of aggression. And, you know, in the case of the United States, you know, that war led to the deaths of at least 500,000 innocent people. And the fact that the United States can go around the planet engaging in wars of aggression and engaging in the threat of the use of force, which is again prohibited by the UN Charter. The fact that the United States can do this, can basically victimize and brutalize defenseless populations around the planet and terrorize them in the case of these drone strikes, which are, you know, based upon a reading of U.S. law, which treats the entire planet as a global battlefield. This is simply unacceptable. And the fact that you look at, you know, both parties after the fact, after the aggression has begun, and you make no distinction between the aggressor and the victim is totally unconscionable. And that is something that we try to reinforce in the letter, which is that we suggest that, you know, Ken Roth and Human Rights Watch adopt the UN Charter as the basis for their legal determinations, given that these kinds of egregious human rights catastrophes occur in large part because of these wars of aggression. In the case of Iraq, you know, the greatest humanitarian crisis of the 21st century. But then we also make a narrower point, which is that if Human Rights Watch claims to remain neutral when it comes to wars, then it has no business advocating for war. And in the case of Ken Roth, we point to a number of his public statements on social media, which are in their effect an advocacy for Syria missile strikes, for the use of force in Syria. And we also discussed the way that Tom Malinowski, who later went on to work for the Obama administration, lauds with complete and unconditional support the NATO interventions of Libya, which have killed many civilians, at least 72, according to Human Rights Watch itself, based on the NATO strikes. So when it comes to maintaining neutrality, why can't Human Rights Watch do even that?
It's an excellent question. I wonder what your take is on the net positive and negative of an organization like Human Rights Watch, which clearly produces numerous useful reports on human rights abuses around the world, but yet it remains indifferent to or actually an advocate of enormous human rights abuses in particular cases. Do we want these organizations around but need them reformed?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's what we're initiating right now, is we're proposing two very simple, very easy to understand, almost uncontroversial proposals. One is a cooling off period, which is immediately recognizable as something important to initiate when you have these kinds of conflicts of interest. And anyone can understand that a former government employee who then becomes the chief lobbyist of Goldman Sachs, who then goes back into the Treasury Department, let's say, is immediately a suspect, and that phenomenon leads to very perverse incentives. I think that the human rights industry should be no different, and I think that that proposal, that cooling off proposal, Human Rights Watch has not been able to launch any substantive rebuttal to that. But and then also the removal of Javier Solana. So these are very simple proposals that we hope will be recognized by the world public as essential before we confer to Human Rights Watch the kind of legitimacy and the kind of reputation that it otherwise enjoys. But I do think that this kind of celebration of human rights organizations misses the point. If they claim to be independent and they're not, then immediately their kinds of advocacy and even their research should be suspect. And secondly, we can point to excellent articles on occasion from the New York Times. That doesn't let the New York Times off the hook, and that doesn't let the New York Times off the hook for its constitution, which is a for-profit corporation that makes money by selling to advertisers its readership. And that structural defect in the New York Times produces all kinds of very, very serious daily kinds of problems in the emphasis that it places on certain stories and not on others. And furthermore, the New York Times, no matter how great its journalism is today, it will never compensate for its behavior as a de facto propaganda arm of the United States government in the lead up to the Iraq War. I think that the filmmaker Michael Moore is absolutely clear and correct when he says that the New York Times has much greater responsibility for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, because this is to be expected of a rogue administration like the Bush administration. But when it comes to the New York Times, which cloaks itself in journalistic integrity and prestige, it has basically no excuse whatsoever for operating as a propaganda arm and disseminating factual falsehoods and very bellicose opinions that flout international law and have no regard whatsoever for, basic constraints on U.S. power. So I think that we should be treating human rights organizations just as we do the corporate media. Nobody lashes too much praise within, left and liberal circles on the Washington Post. Yes, they provide valuable information, but I think everyone understands that its framing and its closeness to power, have very deep and very structural defects for those who are fighting for a more just world.
Just quickly, are there other human rights organizations that have in place the policy of closing the revolving door and the cooling off period? Does Amnesty International have the sorts of procedures you're looking for?
I'm not aware that Amnesty International has any kind of a proposal, or any kind of policy, rather, for that. I do know that Amnesty, by its constitution, is slightly different. It relies a lot more on grassroots donors and originated in an effort to engage in a lot of letter writing campaigns to free political prisoners. So its historical trajectory and the kind of institutional priorities emerged in a different context than Human Rights Watch. And Human Rights Watch, has long kind of allied itself and ingratiated itself, insinuated itself into the Washington Beltway establishment.
But Amnesty took on someone from that establishment and then took out big ads in Chicago thanking NATO for the war on Afghanistan and everything does for women's
That's
rights.
Right.
I mean, it seems...
So there's certainly defects. For example, Suzanne Nossel, who worked at the State Department, who coined the term supposedly, you know, American soft power, became the executive director, I believe, for a brief period before, from what I've gathered from certain sources, there was an internal revolt amongst Amnesty employees, and she basically was forced out of that position subsequently. But yes, you know, these are the kinds of phenomena that you will see at Amnesty, and I think that it's also something that emerges from an imperial culture, you know. So I've brought up, you know, very structural, material components that produce some of these kinds of very biased advocacy priorities. But I think that there's also a cultural dimension to it. And so if you look at the Harvard faculty, and if you look at, you know, the way that people at Georgetown and Yale Law School and others think, they have internalized a value system that is consistent with the priorities of maintaining a global empire. And I think that should not be understated, that these cultural components of thinking of the United States as a shining city on a hill, a country that has long promoted peace and democracy and freedom across the planet for its history. I think that these kinds of national myths and a kind of a self-perception as a legitimate good faith actor and its politicians as people who represent the kind of most noble aims of the general public. All of these things are very pernicious, and I think that they lead to this kind of advocacy. We must stay in Afghanistan because, yes, we may have committed crimes, but the intent was noble, and you know, what will happen to women and girls and human rights if we depart? So these are should be attributed a lot to the value system, as citizens of an empire.
We have been speaking with Keen Bhatt. You can find the letters to Human Rights Watch at alternet.org. You can find a petition that we have set up to Human Rights Watch at rootsaction.org, which over 15,000 people have signed, and you can add your name to it, and you can do your bit to change that culture that Keen was just describing. Keen, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure, David, and keep doing all of your excellent work.
Same to you. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. peace is the way. Until next time.